Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the new Google Oceans, you can hop from the Great Barrier Reef to the Galapagos, from the churn of the surf to the blackest depths of the sea in a matter of seconds with the click of a mouse. Oceanographer and botanist Sylvia Earle has been there too, but for real, in warm water and cold all over the planet. At 73, she spent almost half a century as a deep ocean explorer, a woman and a brilliant scientist, opening the seas. This hour, On Point oceanographer and explorer Sylvia Earle. You can join the conversation. Are you a diver, a deep sea diver? What do you see going on in our oceans? What's your question for the woman who has lived there? Joining me now from San Francisco is Sylvia Earle, National Geographic Explorer in Residence and Chief Advisor to Ocean in Google Earth. It was her prodding that got Google Earth extended to the sea. A lifelong ocean explorer and record-setting deep diver, she's led more than 50 expeditions and logged more than 6,000 hours underwater. Former Chief Scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, she's done pathbreaking work on algae, coral reefs, and marine mammals. She helped move former President George W. Bush to set aside parts of the Pacific Ocean as marine monuments. The Library of Congress calls her a living legend. She won the TED Prize last week and is co-editor of National Geographic's new Ocean and Illustrated Atlas. Woo! Sylvia Earle, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be on board.
It's absolutely wonderful to have you. We want to talk a lot about oceans, and we want to talk about your lifetime as a woman in this neck of the woods of exploration. I wish you'd take us all the way back to the 1960s when you were first really getting your feet wet, and it wasn't that common for a woman and a young mother to be doing what you were doing. How were you welcomed into the world of ocean exploration, or were you?
Oh, well, I had a chance for the first time to go out of the country big time on a National Science Foundation-sponsored expedition, the International Indian Ocean Expedition, 1964. Mm-hmm. It was only after I had been asked to participate as a botanist that it was noticed that I'd be the only woman with 70 men. And the Mombasa Daily Times interviewed all of the scientists on board. There were 12 of us among the crew. And
one woman, really, 70 men, you with two kids at home, two and four, as
right?
I recall. Yeah.
And an understanding husband, fortunately.
Yeah.
And they interviewed us, and we earnestly asked, you know, responded to the questions. But the headline the next day was, Sylvia sails away with 70 men. The subtitle was, but she expects no problems. The real problem that all of us faced, though, was there we were, Indian Ocean, average depth, more than 2 miles. Mm-hmm. We had scuba tanks, among the very first to be used for scientific exploration, and our job was to explore the ocean, and we could get to the very top of it. Even then, it occurred to me that we had to do better than that, that the ocean is really mostly deep, dark, cold, and beyond the reach of most of us most of the time.
You've been as deep as almost anybody in it, though. Flash forward with us to 1979. You made rather famous walk, untethered on the sea floor. I've seen it called an untethered walk deeper than any human before or since has ever walked. Where was that? What were the circumstances, Sylvia?
I used a system called JIM, J-I-M, named after the first person foolish enough to try it. Actually, he survived, I survived. It's a common tool used in the offshore oil and gas industry, or it was. Now it's been largely replaced by remotely operated systems and other more sophisticated diving systems. But
this is a giant suit. Looks kind of like a super-duper astronaut suit crossed with 20,000 leagues beneath the sea, the great big
like
spherical
that,
helmet and all the rest.
Like the Michelin Man.
Yeah.
But it's a so-called hard suit. That is, stiff arms and legs, but with flexible joints so that you actually can walk. Normally, it's deployed with a tether from the surface. Mm-hmm. And this one time that I think it's never been done before, hadn't been done before, probably hasn't been done since, I went down strapped to the nose of a little submarine. We didn't start out that way. As it turns out, the boat that we had wasn't able to maintain steady position in the sea, so we generated this unique approach to get to the sea floor, where I stayed strapped to the front of the submarine like a big hood ornament until we got to the bottom, and then I was released and I could walk free at the bottom of the sea with no tether back to the surface.
Good Lord, not so big. I've seen you described as 5'3", 110, so bantam weight. Could have been bigger, but nevertheless. Dr. Earle, where was this? Where in the world? Where in the sea?
It was off the island of Oahu in Hawaii, but it was 6 miles offshore and 1,250 feet, 400 meters down. It was beautiful. It was dark, of course, when I got below about 500 feet. You get to the twilight zone where it's almost dark, almost light, and you keep going, and it just gets darker and bluer and then almost purple-black, and finally it's really dark except for this flash, sparkle, and glow of those luminous creatures that have their own living light. And finally we got to the bottom, and there were corals down there. Most people think of corals as those creatures that live in the sunlit upper 100 feet or so of the ocean, but there are many corals, fields of corals, whole reefs of corals that live in the dark. And most of the corals that dominated this area were big whisker-like, unbranched corals. They look like giant bed springs. When I touched them, they burst with rings of blue fire that rippled up and down the whole length of these spiraling creatures.
This is luminescence.
It was glorious.
What about your light? You must have had all battery-powered light. How big a beam? What could you see at 1,250 feet down?
Well, curiously, that water is so clear, and it was midday. I could make out the shapes of the big sea fans and corals even at without my lights. But when the submarine that was standing by nearby turned on its lights, we could see this whole field of life. But then I asked for the lights to be turned off, and you could see these luminous creatures. I mean, it is really a lively place. People have traditionally thought of the open as kind of a barren, empty place, but that's just not true. Every spoonful of water in the ocean is filled with life. Even when the water looks clear, it turns out that literally millions, hundreds of millions of microbes occupy every drop of ocean water. You know, it's a living system.
Forgive my hunger, insatiable maybe for detail here, but most of us will never be at 1,250 feet below the surface of the sea. Was it the same submarine that brought you down that lit up that field?
Yeah. Well, I was inside of the walking suit, and the submarine that I rode down, basically, on a little platform in the front of it, the submarine had lights that illuminated a small pool of the ocean near where I walked around.
And why did you untether? I mean, was that considered crazy? Was that the plan?
Untethered at
that depth? Why?
That was the plan. I did have a communication line that linked me back to the submarine so that we could communicate effectively, and then the submarine could communicate back to the surface. It was, I don't know, we worked it out, and I trusted the engineers with whom I worked to make certain that the safety factor was good enough. I'm really most worried concerning safety when I get on a freeway. Diving in submarines is really safe compared to driving a car.
What motivated you in those days? I just loved reading about your life story. It's such an impressive story of scientific accomplishment. But you were clearly just a ball of motivated interest to do this. I looked at an article 20 years ago. You're 73 now. 20 years ago, John McCosker at the Steinhardt Aquarium in San Francisco was saying that maybe you had mellowed a bit. He said, I mean that Sylvia, in her most enthusiastic state of life, is just too hot to handle. You were on fire with a motivation. What was the source for you?
Well, I think it's the same source that motivates every explorer, every scientist that I know. We start out as little kids, and then we never quite grow up. Little kids, after all, start by asking questions. You know, who, what, why, when? And we just never stop. I am as intrigued now as I think I was as a five-year-old about wanting to know what's around the next corner, what's under the next rock. But it's life in the ocean that completely mesmerizes me. Every small critter, every large critter, they're miracles. So are human beings. But to realize that we're a part of the this amazing living system. I can't imagine anybody ever being bored. You look around and pick up the tiniest thing, a leaf, a handful of sand, and just try to imagine how it all came to be. It's just endlessly fascinating. I just can't wait to see what is going to happen next.
And do we really have Google Ocean because you gave Google a kick in the pants?
Well, I credit John Hanke first and foremost, but then the entire Google team for picking up on this and then just making it happen. It really began about 3 years ago at a conference in Spain, where both John Hanke, who is the head of Google Earth, and the company that mm-hmm. preceded it, that Google acquired, we were both being honored with awards, and we each had about 15 minutes to say something about something. And I spoke about the ocean, of course, but then I saluted John and Google for the miraculous creation of Google Earth, where you can fly around, see mm-hmm. your backyard, look at your neighbor's mm-hmm. backyard, mm-hmm. find Starbucks, fly the Grand Canyon. And I said, it just popped out. I didn't really intend to say it, but it just happened. I said, John, I hope someday you finish it. You've done a great job with the dirt, with the land, but the ocean, all that water. Most of the planet is still not there. And he said that it was like a stab in the heart.
What about the waters in Sylvia Earle? And now we've got Google Earth. We're going to come back after a short break and look at that with the famous oceanographer Sylvia Earle. Here's a volcanic tremor near Japan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point Underwater. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with ocean explorer Sylvia Earle about a life underwater and the fate of our seas. Blue whales in the North Pacific right there. Sylvia Earle has spent a lifetime in and under the sea. We're going to do some diving on Google Earth oceans in just a moment, but let's get Sylvia Earle joins us from San Francisco. Let's get a caller or two. Nels in Farmville, Virginia. You're on the air with Sylvia Earle. Hi, Nels.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Sylvia. Thanks for taking my call.
I'm glad to speak with you.
What's on your mind, Nels?
I am one of the luckiest of men. I started scuba diving in La Jolla in 1955-56 and have done it in the Caribbean and a few other places, but I've never been below 200 feet.
How does 1250 sound to you?
That is amazing. Free diving, walking around, untethered. And my question for Sylvia is, what degradation has she noticed in deeper waters? We know that the corals and the sea fans and the other growing things are getting degraded in the upper reaches of the Caribbean. Is there anything like that deeper?
Sylvia Earle?
Sadly, yes. Since you and I began diving in the 1950s, we've learned more about the ocean than during all preceding history, but at the same time, we've lost more. What we can see on beaches, the trash, the debris that comes washed ashore, and when you go out far at sea, you can still see the evidence of what we're putting into the sea. We certainly have seen, I'm sure you have witnessed, the degradation of kelp forests and coral reefs and diving places that people go diving. But I have yet to be in a submarine, and I've actually had a chance with one-person systems to be down at 3,000 feet, well, actually 1,000 meters, a little bit more than that, and in a Japanese sub going down the Shinkai 6,500, 2.5 miles beneath the surface, and there's trash down there. Worse, I've seen places along the Florida coast and elsewhere in the Gulf of Mexico where trawlers have dragged their nets, their scrapers across the seafloor, and it looks like a superhighway 2,000 feet down. It really breaks your heart.
What's the point of doing that at that depth? I mean, what's down there that they could possibly want?
Well, there's some deep sea shrimp that live and are sell for a high enough price to make it worthwhile, and of course, bottom dwelling fish. I haven't seen it personally, but I have seen images from deep water off Australia, New Zealand, where orange roughy are gathered. In my local supermarket in Oakland, California, I just looked yesterday and I saw orange roughy for sale, $9.99 a pound. Those fish may be 30 years old before they mature. They live to be 100 or even 200 years old. We don't raise 200-year-old cows and chickens. We're taking old fish that live in deep water. In the process of taking them, you destroy forests of coral that may be 5,000, 6,000, 8,000 years old. It's just insane. But because people don't know, and even the fishermen may not know, the real cost of what they're extracting from the sea.
You know, having seen a photo of this in the National Geographic Atlas that you've been involved with, Ocean and Illustrated Atlas, there's a photo in there of orange roughy. They call, I guess, slime heads, they're often called.
That's a scientific designation.
Very scientific, slime head. But I have to say, I mean, I have eaten them off a menu. I had no idea. I could never do it again. You could be eating a 200-year-old fish. There's like making a turtle sandwich out of a Galapagos turtle, for heaven's sake. Who could do that?
Once you know, that's the thing. I used to eat seafood, too, but I can't anymore. I know too much. It isn't just the orange roughy. It's sharks. Orange roughy, sharks, tunas, we've burned our way through about 90% of the big fish in the sea, and many of the smaller ones, too. Things such as menhaden are being cooked down to be used for fertilizer, for oil that is sold in little capsules and animal food and other uses. Fish should not be regarded as commodities. They're part of what makes the ocean live, and the ocean is what makes us live.
But to Nell's question, is there no place deep enough, remote enough, that it's kind of held pristine merely by its inaccessibility?
50 years ago, that was true. That's not true anymore. There are few places in the ocean now that are beyond the reach of fishermen's hooks, lines, trawls, dredges, nets, whatever, and other. Deep-sea mining is now coming back on the horizon. Back in the 1980s, it was the hot news of trying to extract metals and other minerals from deep-sea sources, from manganese nodules. Now, the crusts around hydrothermal vents are being looked at hungrily by certain companies that are interested in essentially bulldozing the ocean floor to bring back these valuable metal-laden crusts. And I'm not against using the ocean or even against mining, as long as we really understand the consequences and the trade-offs. We really need to explore before we exploit, and I mean really explore, really understand the consequences of extracting whatever it is, fish, minerals, sand, oil, gas. So far, we've only been looking at the short-term gain, not the long-term consequences.
Explore before exploit. Let's get a call from Woods Hole, Massachusetts, no small seafaring location. And Carla, Carla, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I work for an organization called Sea Education Association. I know Dr. Earle is familiar with us. We run the Sea Semester program for undergraduates from all academic majors. And we talk a lot about communicating the importance of the ocean and why an ocean education is essential for everybody, not just students and, you know, any type of major, yeah, but for the general public. And I was wondering if Dr. Earle could comment on how she has worked to do that, especially through Google Ocean, and then how we can do that moving forward with the increasing awareness of environmental issues and climate change and things of that sort.
Sea awareness. And let's do it first, if we may, Sylvia Earle. And thanks, Carla. Let's do it with Google Ocean. I've got a laptop set up here on my desktop. You've been engaged with this. I guess you're the chief advisor, chief scientific advisor. Can you give us
as they say, the spouting whale gets the harpoon.
Yeah. Right, so we see it in your side there.
When John Hanke agreed that, yes, they did need to do something about Google Earth to make it whole, he said, well, okay, what do we do? And I said, well, my brain isn't big enough to really tell you what it is. So we engaged some of the best minds that we could, advisors, including some from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, Monterey Research Institute, of course, the National Geographic, the Navy, institutions from around the world to weigh in and guide us, and they have over the past 3 years, working with the great Google engineers, the Googlers, many who devoted their 20% time. Google allows their employees to use 20% of their time more or less as they like, within the grand framework of what works for Google. And later it turned into 200% time as they really got engaged, and especially the past year, of working hard to identify how to not only put a map on the ocean floor, the bathymetry, but then to load it with information about the living ocean. By the way, Sea Education is a wonderful organization. I've been a supporter of SEA for years, getting people to directly and intimately go out and get to know the ocean as students with researchers on board. And what, in answer to the question, how do you get people turned on about the ocean? Any way you can.
let's dive in. I've got Google Ocean under my mouse right here. I'm at your command.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Where shall we go? Point me. Where shall I head?
Well, how about Monterey Bay? It's
okay.
Not so far away.
I've got the globe here on the screen. It's spinning. I feel like an astronaut coming in from the moon, but I'm splashing down Monterey Bay. I'm there, and I see the California coast. I see on Google Ocean here, this is the topography of the floor of the ocean just off Monterey. Wow.
Let's pause.
That's already cool.
Pause at the surface. Don't dive in yet.
Okay. All right. I'm just above it. I'll hold that pose.
Can you see the wavy surface?
Yes, I can. I feel as though I'm looking down through a wavy surface at crevasses and topography that I wouldn't have known.
Well, one of the big challenges for the engineers was creating that wavy surface.
Okay. Who
so
knew?
That it really looks as though you're going into the water, and then integrating that deep terrain with surface terrain. Mm-hmm. When Google Earth was first devised, they hadn't thought about negative elevation, as they call it. That is what is below sea level. Mm-hmm. So that's been a major challenge, wedding surface topography with subsurface topography. But now it's there. And the shoreline was another big challenge. And I have to say, it's just going to get better. As you look around, you can see blue and white dots.
Yes.
That's part of the Explore the Ocean layer that the National Geographic and Deep Ocean Exploration Research, working with the National Geographic and Google, and these advisors, really now hundreds of individuals have contributed material that you can find on those little, if you touch one of those little blue and white dots, you can find surfing zones. It's just terrific.
I'm looking here at seals underwater just off Monterey.
Hey, that's one of the things you can do. See, it's not good enough just to see the terrain. To be able to touch one of those little dots and literally dive in. But have you dived in? Have you gone below the surface?
Yes, I'm just going in now. I'm going to have to control my nausea as I descend across this swirling planet.
No, Take your Dramamine.
I got my Dramamine. Now I'm underwater and I'm cruising over this terrain. I've just gone over a big cliff. It's just become much deeper beneath me here. Very cool.
Right.
How much of the world's ocean floor is mapped in this much detail?
Huh. Sadly, not much, only about 5%. And Monterey is kind of special. One of the reasons that I suggested that we go there for starters, because this is the dream, to be able to do for all of the ocean what you can now do in Monterey. All of the ocean has some of the terrain, at least in broad strokes, now visible. But imagine being able to go with the kind of resolution that is now possible in a few places, such as Monterey. And here's the other thing. A few places are beginning to be photographed, so you can actually see underwater, not just the terrain, not just the acoustically derived information.
Because this is all kind of not animated, but this is computer generated, and you're saying increasingly filling in photographic
images.
Of,
yes.
Wow.
Yes, just as you can on the land.
Yeah.
You can look at your own backyard, but how about the fish's backyard?
Well, I'm just soaring along here like a very, very fast underwater diver. Let's go plunging up and take a little trip to the West if we can. I saw Hawaii out there, and you've been involved in this new national monument that George W. Bush described. Maybe we can get out in that neck of the woods. I'm now soaring up above the planet, looking down on the ocean, the Pacific Ocean here. There's Hawaii, Oahu, and stretching out to the west, northwest of Midway Islands, and I think this is the region of much of this new ocean preserve.
That's right. You might notice that there's a line that is sketched around.
Yes, it looks like a long worm stretching up toward Japan from Hawaii here, and a kind of underwater extension of the Hawaiian Islands. I'm not sure how to describe that, but so the ones that didn't make it above water, that didn't become islands here.
And there is, as you'll see, a delineation of where this new national monument is.
It's vast.
It is. It's on the order of 140,000 square miles. That's bigger than all of the national parks put together. It was a wonderful move on the part of President Bush back in 2006. And on the 6th of January, another 195,000 square miles of ocean were added in the Western Pacific, embracing, again, U.S. territorial waters with a national monument, which means that, curiously, these are places that where even the fish are mostly safe. And it's a fraction, all of the marine protected areas. You can find them on Google Earth as a marine protected areas layer that the World Conservation Union has organized. About 4,500 places are designated, and that sounds like a lot. And it's great good news that there are some, like national parks in the sea. But the bad news is that while about 12% of the land globally is protected, really now it's like 0.8% of 0.8 of 1% of the ocean.
Wow.
And with all of these new protected areas that have been added by this country in the last 3 years.
Still a decimal point.
It moved the needle up from 0.6 to 0.8 of 1%. So we've got a long way to go to protect the blue heart of what makes the planet work.
I want to talk more about that.
We're off to a good start. Yeah.
Let me get a quick call before the break here. Marie, you're on the air with Sylvia Earle. Marie, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Very well.
First, it was fascinating to listen to Sylvia's discussion, her story, especially as an environmental scientist myself. And I want to say I use Google Earth often for displaying data interactively, so I'm very excited that we'll be able to do that on the ocean as well.
Mm.
But my question is, I work with the Girl Scouts, and we have a major conference for older girls in Newport, Rhode Island this March, and I want to know what Sylvia's advice for young women trying to pursue jobs in the environmental field in, say, the next 10 years are. Like, what opportunities do you see for them?
Advice to young women. We'll get what we can before the break coming right up here, Marie. Sylvia, your opening advice there.
Well, with respect to the ocean, remember, half the fish are female, half the dolphins, whales. There's plenty of room, plenty of need for women to plunge right in there. And the next 10 years may be the most important in the next 10,000 years. So while it may seem daunting, it is really important. And if it is what you love, you'll be good at it. You'll be good at whatever it is that makes your heartbeat fast if you just follow that path. We need, you don't have to be a scientist, although it's great to have scientists turn their attention to the sea. We need those who are good at whatever they're good at to use their talents. Is it with numbers or with law, with music? Use your talents to celebrate and do what you can to understand the ocean and bring others along with taking care of what makes the planet work.
Sylvia Earle, hold that thought. We'll come back and look more at the oceans, at women in the oceans. And we have one extraordinary woman who spent much of her life in the deep blue seas with us this hour, Sylvia Earle, former head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, chief scientist there, I should say. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll go out with humpback whales off Alaska. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with seagulls off Australia there and with ocean explorer this hour, Sylvia Earle, talking about a life underwater and the fate of our seas. Sylvia Earle is National Geographic's Explorer in Residence, Chief Advisor to Ocean in Google Earth, co-author with Linda Glover of Ocean and Illustrated Atlas, just out from National Geographic. She just was awarded the TED Prize, last week, a lifelong oceanographer, marine botanist, and biologist. You name it, underwater, she's been there. Let's get a call from Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Mark. Hi, Mark. You're on the air with Dr. Earle.
Hi, Tom. First, I'd like to say that I think Dr. Earle is one of my heroes, along with Jacques Cousteau. And I love what she does. And second, she had mentioned earlier there was some talk about the menhadens, and that's this last year we noticed along the coast here, we do a dolphin watch eco tour out of Murrells Inlet, and we noticed that the menhadens had just disappeared last year. And it was pretty odd because normally they're here in big schools.
What's a menhaden? What's a menhaden, Mark?
Basically, around here, it's what we call it. It's a small bait fish, a small swing fish that you see in these large, giant schools that move down during the spring and early summer. And they're kind of a major feeding source for the dolphins. So we saw a big change in the dolphin behavior of them hanging out more around jetties and, I guess, looking for species of fish that come out of the jetties rather than on those schooling menhadens, which, you know, like I said, were disappearing. But my question or comment is that, you know, along the coast here, I'm kind of astounded by just sort of the attitude along here, and it may be in other places too, but, you know, in Myrtle Beach and the Grand Strand area, this is an area where people come to go, you know, what lures them is coming to the ocean. And then it's like they get to the ocean and they draw a line and it seems like they dig their heels in and sort of forget what is beyond that sand line or just beyond the break of the shore there. And you kind of see it in the attitude with the government, the local government along here. You really don't see any proactive movement, you know, to stop the trash and the dumping and all this kind of stuff. And, I mean, I can go back in the rivers here and show you places that, I mean, it just breaks your heart when you see the amount of garbage that would pile up in these bends in the rivers, and all of those flow right into the ocean. And I guess on our boat, we try to, you know, that's my main focus now. Is there's so much I could talk about, but at the end of the trip, I always try to just get people to take care of their plastic. And I was just wondering what Dr. Earle thought would be a good way to kind of slap a hair lip on these local governments and get them to snap out of it a little bit.
Sylvia Earle, how do you get people to extend their mind past the beach line?
Well, one of the reasons I am so thrilled about the existence of the ocean in Google Earth is that it's a way to reach now more than 400 million people. It's not the whole world yet, but at least it's a start. To see the world as a whole, to see the connections between upstream and downstream. And one of the things I tried to do in a little overview piece working with the National Geographic, if you click on this layer and you go to explore the ocean, the first thing that you find is it's like Oceans 101. Why do the oceans matter? What is it that you can do to take care of the ocean that takes care of you? Most people really don't appreciate that the ocean gives us most of the oxygen, the living ocean, the little creatures in the sea that generate oxygen and absorb carbon dioxide, that most of the water that falls as rain, sleet, and snow comes from the sea. It's where 97% of Earth's water is located. Take away the ocean, you've got a planet a whole lot like Mars. Until fairly recently, we have been able to take the ocean for granted. Even Rachel Carson, Jacques Cousteau, going back to the 50s, just thought that the ocean was infinite in its capacity to yield whatever we wanted to take out of it and to absorb whatever we wanted to put into it. But we know better today, and the caller certainly knows better because he's seen the decline of populations of creatures that once were seemingly secure and forever, like the dolphins, like menhaden. Menhaden should be totally protected. They are a keystone species. They are the middlemen that take plankton, the planktonic plants that are so small that big fish cannot eat them. They rely on small fish, mostly thinking about menhaden as a critical creature that that feeds right at the bottom of the food chain. Mm-hmm. And then it translates the sun's energy through those little photosynthesizers into protein that then goes right up the food chain to the whales, to the dolphins, to dozens of different kinds of fish, probably hundreds of kinds of fish. They are small, and once were so abundant that it would, the sea, when you came across a school of them, it looked as though the sea was comprised more of fish than water. But that's changed because we have aggressively taken menhaden from the sea. One of the reasons for fertilizer, for animal food, and now, perversely, for omega-3 oils. People think it's good for them, and it is, but it isn't good for the ocean to take fish oil. We should actually be taking the capsules that are made from plants that are grown, the marine plants. There are at least two companies, maybe more, that actually grow the plants that the fish eat, and we can get it without killing fish. And
every time you turn around, there's something you shouldn't be doing. You're kidding me. Well, when I pop a fish oil capsule in the morning,
don't do it.
I'm taking down menhaden.
You probably are.
Sending the dolphins to beg at the jetty? I can't. Oh,
that's
no.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Oh, no.
So look for the plant-derived products.
Will
that,
do. Promise.
That
I promise.
Bypass the fish.
Okay.
Fish don't synthesize these things.
Oh,
and
boy.
when you eat the fish or get the fish oils, you're likely to get the things that the fish have been eating that you don't want in you, like all the mercury and the fire retardants and heaven knows what else get concentrated in the creatures that have gone, taken what's
you're
in
readjusting
the ocean
my kitchen cabinet even as we speak. Let me go to Bonita Springs, Florida, and Leah. Leah, you're on the air with Sylvia Earle.
Yes, I am. Aloha. I'm from Hawaii.
Aloha. Hey.
Yeah. So, I actually worked as a diver for about 10 years. I started out in underwater photography and then switched to catching and selling tropical fish all over the world, but I gave it up because I could see the impact that I was having on the ocean, and I had a terrible guilty conscience. So I just gave it up and went back to fun diving. But the deepest I ever went was 120 feet, and I thought that was pretty impressive. So
it
1,500
is.
Feet, you know, I'll take my hat off to you.
There you go. A salute from the Hawaiian transplanted to Bonita Springs, Florida.
Well, and here's the thing. That's an example of now that you know, it changes your life. It's all about knowing. Those who have the gift of understanding move on it, act on it. But you may not care even if you know, but you can't care if you don't know. Mm. And the reason I was so excited, am so excited about the ocean in Google Earth and why I love doing books with the National Geographic. I've done 4 kids' books and I've done a number of others prior to this one, the Atlas of the Ocean with my pal and geologist friend Linda Glover. Mm. It encourages people, gives not only did I learn a lot in doing it, but it's a way to communicate to people, to give them the gift of knowing.
Let's go to Asheville, North Carolina, and Eberhardt. Eberhardt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Eberhardt?
I have a question. Years ago when I was in college, I worked my way through in the Merchant Marine and worked on an oceanographic research vessel on the East Coast for a number of years. And we monitored a number of very large dumping grounds that were reserved for particular chemical corporations off the coast of Delaware. And when I looked at the ocean, when I looked at the charts, the East Coast was filled with one after the next of these huge dumping grounds in prime, what I would consider prime fishing areas. I was just wondering who's in charge of regulating that and how, if any, changes have been made since that time. Because when we monitored these sites, there was no life from top to bottom. So the question is, are we moving forward on regulating huge areas off the East Coast that obviously impact us as human beings?
Sylvia?
Great question. In the last 50 years, we certainly have improved our approach to the ocean, but we certainly haven't gone far enough. The heavy-handed industrial fishing continues in this country as well as in nations around the world. It is better, but we need to amp up. We need to understand that the ocean is crucial as our life support system. First and foremost, people have valued the ocean largely because it is a dumping place, or has been used that way, and as a place where we can extract things. And historically, the impression has been that the ocean is so big, so vast, so resilient, that we could get away with doing whatever we wanted to. The phrase was, you can deep six something, throw it in the ocean, it would essentially disappear. We now know that there is no away on this little blue planet, that whatever we do is there for a part of whatever it is that we will have to deal with henceforth. We have committed some terrible things with respect to damaging both the land and the sea. Mountaintop removal to get at coal is terribly destructive. There's just no sense in doing things in that way. Trawling for shrimp just doesn't make any sense. We take big swaths of the ocean using these nets that scrape the seafloor like bulldozers to catch songbirds out of a forest. You destroy the forest and take home a few pounds of protein, but it takes a long time, if ever, to recover from a single swipe of a bottom trawl, just as a bulldozer through a forest.
And that's just a piece of it. I'm looking at a photograph here from the National Geographic Ocean Atlas, and there's an albatross chick here. It's it's what parents would have flown hundreds of miles to find food for. It brought it back, and it's died and been
crammed with plastic.
Cut open. There's a mosaic here of all the plastic that was inside this albatross chick. I mean, I see multiple cigarette lighters in here, bottle spouts and bottle
toothbrushes,
plastic. It's an unbelievable pile of plastic that came out of the guts of this poor chick. It's just unbelievable. Let me get a call from Marblehead, Massachusetts. And Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've known Sylvia a long time. She's one of my great heroes. I got two questions for her. Is Viagra and Cialis going to help save shark depletion? And how do we get those Japanese and Norwegians to stop taking whales in the name of science?
Great. Viagra and Cialis, because, of course, many in the Chinese culture, shark's fin is considered an aphrodisiac. What do you think? Can we move those folks off shark's fin, Sylvia, and onto something else?
It is about knowing, again. There's a little organization called Wild Aid. They've convinced Yao Ming to stand up and say, a big basketball player in China, on Chinese television, I will never eat shark fin soup again, and other heroes to lead the way, basically. Knowledge is the key, but also following the advice of people for whom you have some respect. It's a cultural thing, and the reason that shark fin soup is so popular is that it's regarded as something very special. And with the new wealth in Asian countries, to be able to, as a gesture of honor to a guest, you serve them something that is very special. It doesn't taste all that good, but there's this aura of it being really extraordinary. And yes, it's supposed to give you mighty powers, but it doesn't have, there's no evidence of that at all. Mm. But there's the illusion of this is a special gift. But if people really understand that you're harming the ocean, I mean, it's one of the most brutal forms of fishing known. First, you use hooks on long lines to catch the sharks that are then dragged up on the deck of a ship. Exceedingly sensitive animals. And do they feel pain? You bet they do. Here these living animals are. With a sharp knife, the fishermen slice off the fins, and while the animal is still alive, it gets tossed back into the ocean. And it, of course, dies, but a slow, painful death. It's barbaric.
And whaling, our time is short, but is whaling up, down, steady state?
It continues. It continues in the name of scientific whaling. And again, it's barbaric. Why would we take animals that are 50, 60, 80, 100 years old, or in the case of bowhead whales, some may live to be 200 years old? Wouldn't we like to know how a fellow vertebrate, an orange ruffy or a bowhead whale or any of these big old mammals or turtles, how they get to be that old? Wouldn't you like to be able to live longer than we do? They have somehow the secret to survival. And the best thing we can think to do with them is eat them or turn them into soup or grind them up for fertilizer or whatever it is we do with creatures from the sea. I think the key is in understanding. First, you have to know. And we need to get to policymakers who are making these guidelines. Fishing, commercial fishing, industrial fishing is subsidized. Whaling is subsidized. There is no real economic benefit, if you look at the big balance sheet, that can be derived from extracting wildlife on this basis.
You've been a pathbreaker as a woman in this field. You'll have young women and young men listening now, but is there any gender barrier anymore to diving in and helping figure out the oceans and building this awareness? Is it open, wide open now?
It's much more open now than it was 50 years ago or 100. But I think it comes to your state of mind and your willingness just to make choices. Whether you're a young man or a young woman, dive in. There are so many ways that the ocean can provide a future for you, and how what you do can make a difference for not just the future of the ocean, but for the future of humankind. We have a chance. We still have roughly 10% of the big fish left in the ocean, and there's still about half the coral reefs in pretty good shape. The ocean is still a vibrant place, but it needs your help.
More than worth saving. Sylvia Earle, ocean explorer extraordinaire. It's been really terrific to have you with us this hour. Thanks for the Google Oceans tour. Thanks for the new Atlas of the Ocean from National Geographic. And thank you for your lifetime of work undersea. We're very grateful.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.